The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Good afternoon. So, first of all, Denise helped me by earlier in her lecture, where she introduced the pre-scramble to Africa, by just using the term anyway, helped me in the sense that mine is sort of right after the scramble I'm going to be talking about. And what I've chosen to do is actually present three vignettes. They're not case studies, because I think a case study would be something more analytical, but three vignettes to sort of look at three different examples of things that happened in the 20th century in Africa, three very different things. The first one being an example of colonialism, the Italians in Asmara in Eritrea. And the second one is a kind of, it's actually not really a specific place. It's not really Algiers. That's a kind of code word for Le Corbusier and what follows, meaning Siam and Team 10 and things like that. And it's really, if the first one was about exerting something over a place, the second one is more about the experiments that began with Le Corbusier but then evolved into something, I think, that became much more specific to the place, meaning what his colleagues and his students learned about Africa and what followed that. And then the third one is something from within, something that developed from within. So if the first one was from without, the second one was more experimenting and eventually having a connection with within. The third one is something that evolved from within. And we'll talk a little bit more about how when I first discovered or started to look at Touba, it was to me something inconceivable. I had no idea that something like this existed. But as I went further into it, I realized that I knew more about it than I thought. So anyway, as I promised, I'll go quickly. So we'll go from east to west, first to Asmara, then to the mythical Algiers and other parts of Africa, and then also, and then later over to Somalia, to Touba. This is, I was trying to debate which one would work the best, so this is the second map. I thought it would be important to start with just a map showing the colonies and where the Europeans had sort of occupied themselves, the Italians in this upper area near the Red Sea, and moving along to a map of its location, Etria's location in Africa, and then Etria and Asmara. This is the landscape that one would pass through going from the sea towards Asmara. Asmara is 2 kilometers above sea level inland. And when the Italians first occupied the coast, they found that the weather was not satisfactory to their liking, so they moved further inland and found Asmara to be good. Also, there was fertile soil there, and the rainfall was good. So it was first thought of as the possibility of creating a self-sufficient agricultural land. And this is the city it became. That evolved, of course. The reason that the Italians looked towards that was partially because of this idea that Europe was moving towards occupying Africa, but also because the Italians were having a crisis at home in terms of populations moving to the city, overpopulation in the cities, and trying to find a way to sort of solve some of those. So the idea was to create these, again, self-sufficient agricultural communities where some of that strain could be taken on. But it began, this is a map from 1895, and it shows the early settlement of Asmara by the Italians. And primarily, a lot of these other indications on the map are, in fact, smaller villages that were already there. It began by a military fort that was built, Campo Cintato, which was built in the sort of center of this area that's shown on the map. And I just wanted to note on this one also this trade route. This is a caravan route that goes from the sea inland and connects to more inland towns and villages, partly because of the fact that it shows that Etruria was already on some kind of a communication network, but at the same time, it also it had a part to play in some of the overlays that happened in terms of the Italian plans. So here's the first real urban plan. This was when the city went from a sort of little military encampment to a more urban or towards a more urban development. This is 1913. And it was done by an Italian civil engineer. And you can see the sort of core of the city. Some of this was built, and then the extensions on either side of that core. And then also you can notice in certain places, the villages of indigeni, which is the places for the inhabitants. And in the next couple of slides, we'll get into the sort of issue of segregation. Actually, this is the one. This is a few years later, 1916. It shows a plan of Asmara. That trade route somehow passes in sort of this way, I think, at this point. But basically, the areas that aren't delineated are the areas for the indigeni, the areas where the Asmarians would stay. And then this darker sort of orange color was the area where the Etrians that had some, the Asmarians that had some relationship with the Italians, meaning through commerce or some other activities, could enter that zone. But anyone that didn't have that permission was not allowed in the zone. And then down below that, you have the further development of Italian, both urban pieces as well as more residential sort of villa-like neighborhoods or quarters. And this is an image of really what the majority of this part of the city was like. It was, and to this day still is, which we can talk about at the end. Some of the first early significant buildings. These two buildings I just show to give an example of the Italians, the sort of eclectic nature of Italian architecture that first happened there and continued to happen, actually, up until the 30s. This was the sort of political seat, and this is a typical street scene, a street front that you might find in Asmara around the early 1900s, which is pretty reminiscent of what you might find in Sicily or in other parts of southern Italy. The theater, which is from about 1919, 1920, was a kind of significant inclusion into the fabric of the city in the sense that it created a venue where art and the artistic aspects of the Italian population started to engage in. In other words, some kind of art world started to evolve so that the Italians felt somehow more like they were at home. And this is an image from somewhere in the 1930s that show these zones. So you can see up at this top one in the north, this is the indigenous zone. These sort of angled blocks were the industrial zones, and then you can see the city being formed here. Later we'll come to the market and some other parts. This is that zone that I talked about earlier, which is primarily a more of a villa zone. In the few books that exist on this, I'd rather speculate that they're not totally right on this. They try to sort of connect every type of 20th century Italian architecture to something that was happening in Asmara, and so they talk about this as these works. I mean, this is a building in Italy. This is what one might call a futurist building. All of you remember the lecture on futurism, of course, in Marinetti and Senelia. So I'm not going to get into that right now, but this is an example of an Asmarian building, three Asmarian buildings that are being sort of talked about as being futuristic. In this one, which I think this, even though I know how much you've heard today about globalism, I'd just like to tell an anecdotal story about this one because I think it's kind of funny. This building has been described as this sort of futuristic building because of its wings and its sort of the idea of flight, as well as this one being sort of more like a locomotive, which is, I think, the reason why there's a juxtaposition of those images. But the story goes is that the engineer who actually designed the cantilever, which I think is, if I remember correctly, is 15 meters, stood on top of the cantilever with a gun. And the two, there's two stories. I guess one is a pessimistic and one is positive and one is negative. You can choose which one you think is which. One story says that if it collapsed, he was going to shoot himself as it was collapsing. And the other one was that he needed the gun because he couldn't get anyone to pull the scaffolding out from underneath because no one believed that it would stand. But it's still there today, so it's kind of interesting. Anyway, I don't know what that says. Sorry. Sorry about that. Don't ask me again. No. Okay. So again, this connection between what was happening in Italy and the architecture that was evolving in that plan that we saw earlier. This is Muzio's Cabruta, which is probably the most famous example of Novecento architecture. And Milan was this is in Milan, and this was a real. This is the most potent example of Novecento. And I always see Novecento as this kind of architecture which you can find in almost every part of Europe, which is this sort of struggle between neoclassicism and modernism and some desire to hold on to some of the qualities to try to imbue the building with some of the qualities that modernism is propounding or proposing, but trying to hold on to some of the past. And obviously the name came from the locals and their attitude about it. This is a building that I have a little movie about, I promise I'll try to get to it quickly. But this is a building. This is Cinema Roma, which is also of Novecento. So now I have to do Alt Tab. Oops, Alt Tab. Oh, here we go. So you'll see it like this. I think this is an interesting clip because it talks about the cinema, but it also talks about this issue of segregation that I talked about earlier.
Video removed due to copyright restrictions.
Okay. At the same time, or shortly after in Italy, modernism had taken seat, and the term rationalismo or rationalism started to take hold. This is Giuseppe Tirani's Casa del Fascio in Como. This is its site. I think this is one of the early drawings of it. One of his most famous buildings, this is also Tirani in Como, the Novo Comune. There's a kind of very close parallel to this building that was built some years later, obviously, in Asmara. But it seemed like that Asmara was this kind of blank canvas that allowed, or the safe zone, I should say, that allowed Italian architects to experiment with things that were, which was far more complex in the urban setting of Italy. And there's some more examples of architecture that falls into that category of rationalism.
Video removed due to copyright restrictions.
So this is Palazzo Valletta. In the courtyard that you just saw in the plan, very reminiscent of some of the rationalist buildings that you'd find in mainland Italy at the time. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these. In some of the literature that I looked at, they said that there were more modern buildings in Asmara than any other city, and they compared it to places like Tel Aviv, which we all know have abundance of modernist architecture. While all of this was happening, Italy was changing as well. In 1922, the fascist party took over, and Mussolini had different designs on Asmara. Rather than it just being this sort of colonial outpost, he saw it as a sort of gateway for his movement into Ethiopia and other parts of Africa. So the city expanded drastically, 50,000 people within a few years. So the city got quite large. So these are just some images of the development of the city at that time, including, you can't make this out very well, but it's a scaffolding with Benito's face projected on it. And then sort of one of the last stories in Asmara. This is a plan from 1938, obviously, again, during the fascist period. And it has also a little story that's kind of interesting. The idea was to have a competition. And at some point, this was organized by the fascist party, but at some point the governor, or the mayor, I mean, of Asmara decided that he would take control of this competition and organize the panel of judges. And it turned out he actually won. He made a submission and won, which created quite a scandal. And so he was booted out of office, and the plan was denied. And so from Rome, Mussolini sent an architect to work on a new master plan, which included, I mean, it's obviously a much more extensive plan than some of the ones you saw earlier, but these areas up here are the indigenous areas, so at least they're at least being shown as somehow on the plan as not just being a sort of nobula or something, but they're actually shown as some kind of housing. And this is a little statement about the scheme, and which makes it quite different from the earlier plans that we saw. The scheme utilized a unique mixed quarter, meaning a place in the center, a buffer zone, and he called it a diaphragm, between the strictly Italian district and the indigenous areas. And that was this marketplace that was proposed, which actually began construction in 38 and wasn't completed until 52. So it was in a stage of construction for quite a long time. But there is somewhere buried in there, I think, a quote of his, although the quotes don't show up, which talks about the fact that the whites would only come in contact with the indigenous people of a higher category because they would be involved in commerce or in trade. So this was his scheme of trying to sort of lessen the racial aspect of the plan. Anyway, these are just some images of contemporary Asmara. And just one last building, because it's a rather unusual one and actually sets the stage a little bit for some of the things that happen in the next vignette. This is an Orthodox church. It actually was built on the site of, it's built on the site of an Orthodox church that had been there before the Italians arrived, that was moved by the Italians and then rebuilt. And it's one of the few examples of a work of architecture done by an Italian who was actually trying to somehow understand something about the indigenous architecture. So you can see these agodo. This is a traditional dwelling of this area, and this kind of thatch roof was used on top of the building. And also in the way that the coursings were worked out between concrete and stone, there was some semblance to a technique that was used often, which you'll see in this another example of a building, which was built by an Italian architect. By an Italian architect earlier. And this is called a monkey head design, where, in fact, within the stonework, there are usually juniper logs that are placed in as ties between the coursings. And so anyway, the idea is that within this kind of coursing, it's at least had some kind of semblance to this historic tectonic or building type. So that's vignette number one. It's meant to sort of spark your interest in Asmara. I think if the discussion would continue on Asmara, it would be interesting to talk about how the Asmarans have taken over the city and how it's become a city, their city. In fact, they were the ones that built it. So the next vignette is kind of funny because, as I said earlier, it was labeled as Algiers, and it's not really Algiers, although you will see Le Corbusier's work, which you're all probably fairly familiar with in Algiers. But it really has a lot more to do with certain acts of experimentation that went on in Africa that began with Le Corbusier's ideas, which were sort of one-sided and utopic, but then sort of spread out into, I think, much more investigatory kind of endeavors by a number of different architects. And the big surprise for me in doing this research was discovering Ernst May, who all of you remember from lectures on his work. Actually, we'll back up or go forward a little bit. His work in Frankfurt, and also this project, which I think was one of the projects that he was in the process of working on around the time that the Nazis took control, which basically made it impossible for him to return to Germany. I don't understand completely how he made his way to Africa, but he stayed in Africa from 1934 to 1953, and his activity there was pretty significant. So this is a sort of introduction to this part, but I just want to show it to you quickly. He worked in Tanzania, he worked in Kenya, he worked in Uganda, and I'll show you some of the projects that he worked on. And if you remember the Siedlung in Frankfurt, which is exactly just to go back to this image, is exactly the reason why Siam II happened in Frankfurt. It was because of the Siedlung. So all of these people descended on Frankfurt because primarily of the work that Ernst May had made there. And then, you know, just some few years later, he was in Africa. So anyway, this is just to give you some examples of that work. This is one of the first projects that he worked on when he arrived there, partly because it was something that he worked on for himself, but it was also something that he was constantly looking at prototypical projects, which we'll see over and over again in some of the other architects' works in Africa. And this was for a farmstead in Tanzania from 1935, and it was using a concrete frame system, which was something that hadn't been used at all in that area prior. Here's a building that he did just a few years later in Nairobi. And you know, you can see all kinds of references to, I don't know, Mendelssohn and other people, but somehow, and also there's some interesting structural work that's been done in this building, but somehow I read that there was some thinking that went on in this building that had to do with the fact that the streets were dirt, and he wanted to develop some kind of mechanism. So whereas you have brisolet in buildings that you'll see soon that are working with the light, that somehow this building was working with the dust and the movement of dust from the streets and trying to keep it from actually making its way into the building. Whether that worked or not, I'm not sure. Another example of some of the things that Ernst May was working on, this is a prototype of a construction. I don't know if you can see it well from there, but it was a concrete construction of a hook slab system that would create this kind of almost Qantas hut type architecture. And he also worked on the expansion of Kampala in Uganda, the capital. But the expansion was using, again, prototypical housing designs that were based on similar kind of themes. This was another study he did in 1947, which is a comparative analysis where you can see, and it was looking at buildings on slope sites and how prototypical buildings could be designed to work on slope sites because he was working on lots of slope sites. And so he has African examples, he has Asian examples, and he has somewhere in there American or US examples. And so he's making a comparative analysis between these buildings. And then a couple sort of fairly significant works. These are both done for the Aga Khan. One was a school in Kenya. They're both in Kisumu, in Kenya. Both around 1950. This is a early childhood education center and a clinic. And so you can still see the even though he was experimenting with lots of sort of traditional architectural forms, there's still an allegiance to some of the earlier ideas of modernism that he had been working with in Frankfurt and Berlin. And one last image of his. I had to show this because it was, to me, somehow quite amazing to discover. You know, we all know Bruno Taut went to Japan. We all know Gropius came to Boston. We all know that Mies went to Chicago. But I don't think many of us have ever talked about the fact or thought about where he went. So these are one last image of him from a British newspaper talking about him not having been to England since 1927 and visiting all of these projects that some of the next colleagues that we'll talk about had been building, like the Smithsons and people like that. So this is where we go to Algiers. And you all remember these because we've talked about Siam and the whole idea of what Siam was and how little by little it became co-opted by Le Corbusier, which you remember from reading your global book. And then also about around, I think this was Siam, I forget forget which one, 1948, Siam 7, I guess, with this whole idea of the grid, this way of presenting material, presenting architectural ideas in a very systematic way. And I show you this only because of the methodology that's used, and this has to do with the standard zoning terms, which I can't read right now, but, you know, housing, communicating, working, and recreating. So those four very simple kind of ideas that Le Corbusier was interested in. This is just an image of the sort of systems that were happening. Although this next group of people were dealing with colonies in Africa, I wouldn't put them in the same category as what went on in Asmara. There was much more experimentation, and in fact, many of these projects were for the inhabitants as opposed to what we saw earlier. So here's Algiers in the postcard, and some projects by Le Corbusier, of course, just to sort of build it off, because that would legitimize my using the word Algiers. But this is a project that one of the first projects he did in 1933 to 34, when he was asked to do a subdivision for, you know, many houses, where, of course, he didn't do that. He created this one enormous block for 300 inhabitants with all of the services in one, connected to a highway, which later comes back in some of the other works. Also, this is a project that I hadn't looked at closely, but I found rather interesting when I did study it. This had to do, again, with the sort of topography dropping down to the sea. And, you know, obviously there's the brise soleil and other issues that have to do with sunlight, which probably have similar conditions, only on the opposite side of the Mediterranean in France, where he was used to dealing with. But this idea of creating this open space at the ground level, not so much for trying to lift the building off the ground like in the Five Points, but to create a view corridor so that people moving along the boulevard would never lose sight of the coast and the ocean, which I found kind of interesting and strange. Here's one of the largest projects. He was relentless in terms of trying to push these projects through. And this one was a project for a skyscraper, which he described as being unlike the accidental American form of skyscraper, and being more from a biological kind of nature, which is something he made allusions to all the time, that his architecture had, you know, this sort of organic biological component, so that these functional elements of play and work and all of that were, you know, sort of almost like circulation systems and things like that, which we'll look at quickly again after. Here's another example of the skyscraper with its brise soleil and multifunctions that are happening. And this is at the marina in Algiers. And then the last project, proposed built project of his, was this huge project, which probably you're familiar with, but this whole idea of linking the harbor part of Algiers with some existing residential quarters that had, you know, were already there, by creating this sort of highway architecture, this sort of building that also had the highway above it, as you can see down here. He obviously was not a person that gave up easily. In 1950, he published this book, The Poet, Poésie sur Alger, and in it he was just reiterating again and again the same kind of concepts. So you can see, you know, these idea of view corridors and sun, and here's the tree and the organic quality of his skyscraper. And also, although I won't get into details, you know, the whole idea that, you know, they desperately needed his ideas. At the same time, other members of Siam were doing other things, but also on the African front. This is a book from 1947 that was Jane Drew and Maxwell Fry, who were both early members of Siam. Some of you know this book, I think, probably very well now. But it's a quite interesting book at sort of evaluating and trying to understand the indigenous culture there, and trying to somehow solve its problems. So in some ways, it may not be so far off from Le Corbusier, but it evolved. They did study both rural and urban architecture, and eventually, as you know from looking in your global book, that they eventually made some significant architecture in Nigeria, the university. But in 1956, they also co-authored another book, which became a real significant book for many reasons. One, because it became a kind of handbook about how to make architecture in places like Africa and South America and other tropical zones. And it was broken down into issues that were far different than those kind of issues that Kubusi had been thinking about in his sort of narrow framed grid. And this is the cover image from the book, and I think the quote's kind of beautiful from thinking of the time. Architecture in the humid tropics is a collaboration with nature to establish a new order which human beings may live in harmony with their surroundings, whatever that may mean. I think that book had quite a significant impact, all the way to the point that when the AA decided to begin its tropical architecture program, which wasn't instigated by Fry, but was instigated by someone else. His name is there, but I forget. Fry was invited and was the inaugural professor there for the first 3 years of its existence. And probably many of you know architects that have studied there. The tropical architecture program at the AA was probably one of the most famous programs of its type in the world, and spurned many other schools. There were schools that opened in Africa as well that were sort of not subsidiaries, but influenced by the teaching methodology that went on there. And many architects from England as well as from the Third World studied there. So back to Le Corbusier just for a second as a kind of another point to sort of move away from. Unité, which is a later work, after even this publication that you just saw earlier, from 1952. Here's the grid that was shown at SIAM 7, which was done by an architect named Candilis. And so I show you these images also because both Candilis as well as Woods and Josic, who eventually will show up in these, who are students who are working with Le Corbusier on the Marseille block. Here are a few of them on the roof during construction. They are in many ways much like the Smithsons and a number of other people. They are members of SIAM near the end, but they are the ones that sort of jump ship and turn SIAM 10 into Team 10. And so they do become significant Team 10 players. So here's some work by Candelas, Josic, and Woods, and some of their, this is them, competition being judged by them. A church that they designed in Morocco in 1952, some housing in Algeria, so Algeria does get validified, minus Corbu, in 1954. And some of the things that they're looking at are not unlike the things that we saw in just briefly, at least in the words that were written in the introduction to Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew's book, that they were looking at these kind of things maybe in a somewhat different way than the sort of single-minded way Le Corbusier had been. For example, the movement of air between units to keep coolness, you know, to keep the units cool during certain times of the year. So they were dealing with sunlight and air and things like that. And also, even though this is a jump for us today, based on the fact of, you know, sort of contextual thinking, the idea that this building steps like this was trying to respond to the topography, so that the fact that the external movement system on the building is somehow dealing with. But I mean, if you think about it, it's from 1953. It's a beginning. It's somehow moving away from a rigid way of thinking. And just a few last images of some projects that they worked on. This actually, I show you this one because this is a real project that they worked on, reconstructing an indigenous neighborhood in Algiers, which ended up, well, you'll see it later, ended up on a board that they created for the first Team 10 conference. And just some more validity to the statement that I made earlier, that there was experimenting going on that was looking at what was happening in Africa as opposed to imposing on it what it believes might be the right thing, as Le Corbusier was. And so you can see in some of these examples of these drawings that they're closely studying the way architecture exists in these places. And so here's this is Siam 9, so it's the beginning of Team 10, so it's before Siam 10. But here's Allison and Peter Smithson's board, which had to do with the streets and the life of London, which, you know, was something that had never made its way onto these boards in such a fashion. So it was pretty radical. But below that, we have the one by Kendallis, Jossick, and Woods, which also, I know you can't make them out, but there are all these, you'll see this image in a little while, all these images that have to do with indigenous architecture and how they could take and learn from that indigenous architecture. This is one of those images where they're showing, you know, sort of everyday objects used by the people in a sort of collage with some idea of building a housing footprint. And then a last study of theirs for Chad, for a development in Chad, where they were looking at the indigenous architecture, and then this is a proposal that they're making of how they could replicate certain conditions that exist within that proposal. And the same thing is true here. Here's an existing floor plan and how you could create something, you know, in a more contemporary way that would obviously allow the same kind of living conditions. And again, down here, they're looking at so it goes from, you know, sort of the section to the plan to the urban fabric and how they can create something, although this one gets a little bit more problematic, but somehow they could create something that has that same kind of nature of the streets and courtyards that were typical of these areas. Which leads me to probably the reason why I actually engaged this study in the first place, which was how I was interested in fact, how architects were learning from Africa and bringing their work back to Europe. And so here's a photograph by Johan Utzon from 1947 from Morocco, looking at these works that we've seen already in other people's presentations and trying to understand something about the courtyard structure that was inherent in these. And then himself, he was invited there by family because he didn't have any work in 47. So at that point, he made two proposals that were single sheets, one page. One is for housing, which we could talk about some other time, in Morocco. And the other was for a textile factory, which, if you know Utzon's work, you know, the sort of roofing system, the sort of way that he dealt with roofs and things like this are all sort of in their incubation stages in these early drawings. But also very much, I think, influenced by this idea of going to this place. This is the beginning of, I think, what maybe Frampton calls what transcultural, or this idea of drawing from another culture and using it within your own. And then just to show you Kingo housing, which you all know from talks earlier from Denmark, the courtyard house in the Danish landscape. And then another project done by a public agency in Casablanca, trying to create, you know, similar kind of quality to the fabric that pre-existed in this kind of courtyard structure, and obviously, you know, more using materials and using contemporary materials and other contemporary ideas. So that's vignette two. So you're still awake. So this one's kind of a funny one. It's the best I could find, but it's if it's wrong, I apologize. But it's meant to talk about the movement of Islam into North Africa. So I'll move it quickly, so I don't have to. If it's bad, I apologize. It was lack of not being able to find something else. But this is the one that fell on me, partly from our main inspiration in this room. And this is showing the Touba in Senegal, a place that I had absolutely no knowledge of prior to doing this, and it's become quite fascinating. Here's the Google Earth image of Touba, and you can see the central mosque and the Pek, which is the central square inside. You can also make out, and we'll talk more in detail, but that's not too much, about some of these axial streets that come out, and then you can't make them out yet because it's not far enough out, but there's also sort of a ring that wraps around it. This whole enterprise, which is probably the most shocking aspect of it, is the mosque was finished in 92, I think, and the city, none of the construction of the city happened until after 1924 or 25, something like that. And if I can call him Bamba, this is the founder. He was a Sufi cleric or teacher who spent a lot of time, and you'll see in a little while a map on a map, a lot of time traveling off into different parts of the region to meditate, and had visions of the city, and believed that it was his mission to create the city, and so it's quite amazing that someone that was born in the late 19th century, eventually by he wrote enormous amount. Some song I heard said that he wrote 7 tons of pages. So he wrote a lot, and in a lot of that writing is some of the indications of how the city is to be planned. The other thing that's interesting about his life, which I guess this is the Babo, you may be able to pronounce it better than I can, but Babo, Baobab. Right, baobab tree, which is, you know, a tree you find all over Africa, but is a significant tree in this region, and also we'll come back to it. But is the tree that Bamba meditates under. So also in Sufi cosmology, there's this diagram that describes the material world as being the sort of Euclidean rectangle down here, and this diagram itself is showing Tuba is at the center of it, and the tree becomes, and this is this tree that Bamba meditates under, becomes the sort of centerpiece of that, and as you can see, the whole cosmological construct of the Sufi ideology or cosmology is there. And anyway, I just read this. The cosmology of the world tree. Tuba, the tree of paradise, is but one manifestation of the tree of the world, postulated by Sufi theosophists. The world tree is a cosmological construct that aims to explain the created universe and its relationship to the creator. This diagram attempts to situate the Sufi city of Tuba within this cosmology, but it can only begin to approximate the spatial relationships involved. Space in the imagined realm of the Malakut, the spiritual realm, is not confined within the Euclidean grid of this diagram. So this is, so here's the theoretical grid, or the theoretical construct that it's created within, and here's the physical reality. So it begins with this grid plan, which is related to, I'll move to the next one because we have another thing to read. The design, it has a distinctive design characterized by the co-joining of elements of the square and the circle. The square element consists of a grid more or less aligned to the, again, Qibla? Yeah, which is obviously the relationship to Mecca. It signifies Muslim space where earthbound quotidian daily acts are aligned with straight path of Islam. The circular element, which consists of radiating avenues and encircling roads, acts as a vertical dimension to the device, to the design. It signifies Tuba as a place of transcendence where life on earth connects to the overarching cosmological reality represented by the world tree. The centrality of the great mosque in the center, and the lampfall, which is the name of the tallest minaret, which we'll come to in a little while, as this vertical marker of these two coexisting geometries. So anyway, this is a bit backwards, but this is the map of Bamba's travels. So he actually was born somewhere in Mabake down here, and traveled in this region, meditating and having these transcendental experiences. And in reading about it, there was almost a sort of images of a life of Brian, that he couldn't get away from people, that people were chasing him wherever he went, and that he kept trying to find a place to be alone. And so he did find this place, and I guess Tuba was the place where he had this transcendental experience of this great city. But also there's another interesting aspect of his life, and that was that he then went into exile. The French found some of his thinking too dangerous, so he went into exile, which was perfect for him, because he felt this exile was exactly what needed to happen for him to be able to carry forth this idea of building this great new city. So anyway, here's the center of the city, and we'll see the mosque in a little while. And if you see this plan first and you don't see how new the mosque is or how recently it was constructed, it's kind of shocking. But here's the center of the city. So this is the Pek, or the Pank, or the central square of the main part of the city. It's connected with the cemetery, which is also considered a space of transcendence. And it also has a number of other significant buildings around it. Every year, there are two dates where there are pilgrimages to this space, and 2 million people, it's interesting, go to YouTube. They have all these pictures of people in cars and buses and vans on their way there, but 2 million people go to this. And also, twice a year, women are allowed to go, which is also kind of interesting. Here's an aerial photograph of the mosque, and you can see the scale of the square is in some relationship to the quantity of people that do arrive for this event. And this is just a sketch that was in a book I found of this tree, and it's no longer there, but it's actually right at the edge of the cemetery, and it had a significance that people actually would go there and carve their names in the tree, which unfortunately probably killed the tree, as from what I read, because that by making connection with this tree, they were making connection with the divine world. So here it is. I was going to put it in black and white, but I decided no. But anyway, this is the lamp fall, and it comes from two different words: lamp, which is from the French word, which obviously means illumination, and fall had something to do with the name of a follower. Not that he fell, but was a follower of his. So it also signifies the place where Bamba had this vision, and also signifies the relationship to his mausoleum. It also can be seen from, according to readings, 15 kilometers away from the city on a clear day. This is the entrance into the mosque and Bamba's mausoleum. And another image of the lamp fall. Again, sort of the symbolic architectural tree. And the other thing I found interesting is I found a number of images of the building not in construction but in reconstruction, and made me think of Gothic cathedrals and other forms of architecture that are never complete, that are always in a state of transition or transformation. So just the last couple images of the inside of the, and just a few last words, because I think these you only know about the mosque. What about the city? That was my big question. So here you can see that ring road. But Touba's urban mandala design results from the city being laid out as a concentric grid. The square components of the configuration is determined by its direction to Mecca. And Touba's concentric component, represented by the radial arteries and the encircling roads, mark the holy city as a transcendental place, a place where the material world connects with ultimate reality. So there's this idea of the path in the real world and this sort of transcendental world in one. And I read also that this ring road, in a way, helps define or hold together this idea of the city. And then the question is, so what about the rest of the city? Well, actually, the rest of the city is constructed in such a way that each neighborhood is a mini component of Touba itself. So you have this public square and a mosque. And you'll see some images of that. And the way that it worked, you don't go to a real estate agent to find your flat there, but it was organized in the sense that Bamba gave the first pieces of land to his sons who were both also teachers and had followers, and so their groups lived within that, and they passed on other pieces of land. So all of the neighborhoods are not just organized in terms of people gathering there, but they belong to a teacher, the teacher forms the sort of center of their community. So here's one example of one of those neighborhoods with that central square, and just another example here. And here's some images of what some of these places look like within the city itself, with this trees. And then I think I've already said this, but the last couple images are really about the aspect that, this one is, let me just go back a second. This one's kind of interesting. This limit of special status has to do with the actual political, economic reality of the city. It's hierarchically organized by the clerics, but it's not a political system. And so everything is done through a sort of series of I don't know what the correct term would be, but sort of pecking orders in terms of who makes decisions about what. They have complete control over the center of the city in terms of the Senegalese government. They deal with the Senegalese government cannot tax them. There's no alcohol or cigarettes or any worldly things that are allowed within that circle. But also, it's completely under their control. It's fairly unheard of from my readings in terms of a kind of political entity. And this just to show you a kind of shocking thing, if you have never heard of the city before, that, you know, in 1912 there were 300 people there. In 2002 there were almost 421,000 people, and the projection that there'll be somewhere near 1,300,000 by 2019 is kind of an extraordinary revelation. So here's sort of this issue. This is that originating village that Bamba was born in, and this is the area of his pilgrimages. And here's the city in its larger format.
Video removed due to copyright restrictions.
When I was working on this on Sunday, trying to pull it together, you know, I thought, this is amazing. This has been wonderful to learn about this place I know nothing about. All of a sudden, this image came to my mind of Yesu Nador, who's an extraordinary musician, all of you probably know. But I went to my CD collection and pulled this CD out. And that piece of music is called Touba, City of Peace. And the rest of the album, which is called Egypt, strangely, I don't know quite, I haven't had time to make the connection. But the rest of the album, at least a third or more of the album, is about Touba and about Bamba and about this whole thing. So what that asked me to do is to sort of dig more. And so I went to sites and I realized there are huge followings in England. There are some in the United States. And so when these pilgrimages happen, which is the only good picture I could find, unless you want to go to YouTube later, people are coming from all over the world to visit this place during pilgrimages, which is, I guess you can do that one next time. So anyway, that's it. Thank you for staying awake. Even when I only teach like to students who just came in for the first time, they don't look this awake.